EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, Senator.
Ares 31, me neither.
71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And it was anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Something. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Emergency 1095. Yeah, something just passed over us. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we thought?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. Same airplanes.
Howdy dispatch.
Okay.
Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls?
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, Bob, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone, wherever in the world you are listening from tonight. We got a great show lined up for you. Our guest is a rarely heard female military UFO witness, Major Laurie Rehfeldt, who was stationed at the nuclear-armed United States Air Force facility at RAF Bentwaters in Suffolk in the United Kingdom at the time of her encounter. Laurie's encounter happened in February 1980 and is very much a precursor to the events that followed a few months later that same year, famously known as the Rendlesham Forest Incident. But first, we are going to start off in Ohio with Eric's witness submission. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show.
Hello, my name's Eric Bush. And what I'm about to convey to everyone that might listen to this is absolutely true. And sometimes as I think about it to this day, it's hard for me to grasp what actually happened. But I'm 54 now. This happened when I was 12, so this would have been around 1977. I've seen 3 things in my life from that was in the sky that I would swear was not produced or made on this planet. I've always been a believer in the fact that we aren't alone in the universe. I don't understand how we could be, given all the recent scientific breakthroughs, finding planets and suns and stars and things out there, the fast radio bursts and all that now we're discovering. It would be really hard to imagine. But anyway, on to my experience. The one experience out of the 3 that I know that still comes back to me all the time was this one. And mostly because I wasn't the only one that witnessed it. My father, my mother, and my sister, and what we later found out was several people in our county, which was Madison County in Ohio. I grew up about 6 miles south of London, Ohio. Some people may or may not know where that's at. I don't know. It's a small little town. But we lived on a small horse farm, and it was about 26 acres. And we were coming home from my aunt's that night. It was a Friday night. We had had dinner with my aunt, and she lived in the town of London. We were getting home rather late, at least later than we normally would, which was around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I would say. And we lived back a long driveway. The driveway was close to a quarter of a mile back. As we were driving up the driveway, my sister's 2 years younger than me, we were sitting in the back seat. And I remember not really paying much attention to what was going on as we were driving up. I knew we'd gotten home and everything, but I heard my dad in kind of a startled voice say, "What are those lights in the back field?" Well, when I heard that, I kind of sat up in the back seat and kind of looked. I didn't see lights per se at first, but what I did notice is back towards where he was talking about, there was like this eerie daytime glow that I could see, which was weird. And then as we went around the curve of our driveway up to where we were getting ready to park the car, I saw them. They were these huge, looked like huge headlights about 100 feet above the field in the back of our property. That field was basically the west end of our property. These huge lights, as I said, were about 100 feet above the field, and in the field, or maybe right above the field, there was two smaller lights that were very bright, but not nearly as big as the ones in the sky. We just kind of stood there. As we got out of the car, we kind of stood there and was amazed at what we were looking at. There was no sound. It was eerily quiet. This was summertime. There was no crickets, nothing. And when you live on a farm, especially in rural Ohio, crickets and frogs and all that are pretty commonplace at that time of night. Nothing. Also, I remember the first thought I had as I stepped out of the car as a 12-year-old was, where's our horses? And then my next thought was, where's our dogs? And to put that in perspective, we had about 8 horses at that time, I believe, and we had 5 dogs that roamed the property. We had several outbuildings, several barns on our property, and those dogs normally stayed in those barns. But on a normal night, they were out in the yard greeting us when we would come home. Not only did we not see those animals, we didn't hear them either. So we stood there watching these lights, and it was a good 2 or 3 minutes that we watched as they just sat there, no noise, and they were probably 200 yards away from us. Then just like that, they go out. They turn off, whatever. And I just remember my dad startled. He was so taken back by what we were seeing, he just kind of muttered like, "Oh no, they went off." And then it was pitch black. What we could see was a faint outline of something rising up higher than the 100 feet or so that it was off the ground. Couldn't see what happened to the small lights in the field, but we could see a shape rising up. And as it rose up, it began to move towards us. And we could tell at that point it was a rather large object. And we just kind of stood there not knowing what to do. And I remember we had a what we called a mercury light on an electric pole that was near the closest barn to our house. And I remember as this object got closer overhead of that, the light started to flicker, and then it went out completely. At that point, as we looked up, we could see a very, very large object over our head with no noise and moving slowly. And what I remember was there was no strobe lights, there was no blinking lights, there was just this weird glow to the underneath of it. And it was almost like an iridescent type of hue. In other words, you know, several different colors you could kind of see glimmer as it went over, but nothing significant, just enough that you could see a glow. It was about 200 feet over our head by the time it got where we were. And we watched it as it moved west to east. And looking back now, I can say that this object was probably 150 feet across. So we're talking a very large object, and it was kind of oval shaped from the underneath. I couldn't see how it was shaped on top of that, but I do know from the underneath it had a huge kind of oval shape to it. So we watched it go to the east very slowly and very quiet. It banked to the northeast, and then we watched it as it flew out of sight and disappeared. Well, we were standing there, not knowing what to say, but as it disappeared, our mercury light came back on. And it was at that time we heard some noises from the horses, and our dogs came out from basically every corner of our property that we could think of. None of our animals were harmed, but they were spooked for sure. And you could tell that their experience of it was frightening. My mother, after a few minutes of silence with us not really knowing what to say, my mother looked at my dad and said, maybe we should call the sheriff's department and report what we saw, you know? And so I remember us going in the house. We still were very taken back by what we'd seen, not sure what to say. I remember hearing my dad's side of the conversation with the sheriff. And, you know, sometimes when someone's on the phone, you can kind of make out what the voice is saying on the other end. And my dad confirmed that after he got off the phone, what I heard. But basically, the sheriff had said, you are the sixth call we've gotten this evening reporting a very similar object in the area. So this was not only witnessed by myself and my family, but this was also witnessed by several people in our county. We never did know, you know, who those people were. The weird thing was that there was never anything in our local paper that I remember. If there was, as a 12-year-old, I just missed it and haven't really researched it as far as a newspaper entry or whatever, but that was the experience that really sticks out to me. Now, my mother died when I was 19, and my father just passed away in 2018 at the age of 84. About 6 months before he died, we were having a conversation, and he brought that night up in conversation and that event. And I know he passed away still in awe of what we had seen, still not understanding what we had seen. And it's just been something that has baffled us for years. I feel like I know what that was related to. I feel like that definitely was an incident that probably had extraterrestrial ramifications to it. I do not believe, especially back at that time, that there were any craft that anyone was talking about that could have done that and had that shape, had that movement, had the no sound, had the eerie glow. It just, none of it added up to anything man-made here on Earth. That's my experience, and, you know, I hope that by me telling this, that someone else may feel comfortable about speaking out. And that's it. It's to this day, it's the weirdest night of my life and something that I truly won't forget for the rest of my life. So anyway, that's it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Eric, for sharing the first recorded submission for the show. You can email me your recorded encounters to ufochronicles@gmail.com. I would like to welcome Major Laurie Rayfelt to the show. Laurie, you came to us from Virginia.
Yes, I do.
And you were stationed at RAF Bentwaters at the end of the 1970s and early 80s?
Yep, I was. I actually went into the Air Force on January 23rd, 1978. And after basic and tech school, I had to fill out what they call the dream sheet. And I put down England as my first choice. And I got it. And I was really excited. When they handed me the orders, it said RAF Bentwaters and UK. And I can remember thinking, UK, what is UK? What is UK? I don't know. What's this place, UK? Someone said, United Kingdom. And I'm thinking, oh, no, not Africa. Thinking of Neutral of Omaha, Wild Kingdom. They said, no, England, Britain. I was like, oh, my God, I'm so excited. I was just a kid. I was 18 at the time. And I got to England, got off at Mildenhall, and got to RAF Bentwaters about the 4th of May of 1978. And it wasn't taking the roads down through England. It really brought back memories when I was there back in the 1960s visiting family. So it was just really... It was just wonderful breathing in the air and, felt like I went back in time. It took about an hour or so to get to RAF Bentwaters. And as soon as we got onto the base, when we got onto the technical side of RAF Bentwaters, so we went by the roundabout, all of a sudden all the buildings were green and there were Quonset huts. And it was just like, oh my God, this is the ugliest place I've ever seen in my life. I really wanted to get back on the bus and go back to Mildenhall where we started out. But when I got off the bus, it was at that point I felt something seemed wrong with the place. It just seemed like I couldn't put my finger on it. It just seemed something was wrong. And I was just hoping the more I got to explore the place, the better I'd feel about it. Over the next several weeks, I went through training, and a lot of the people there were just really, really obnoxious and sarcastic and saying, well, who do you think you are? And, you're just a WAF, a woman. That WAF is a woman in the Air Force. And they didn't use that term even back then, but there was really, you could tell that people were not happy to get a woman there. And I didn't know, I was just an 18-year-old kid. So over time, I was finally part of on Bravo flight, B flight, and then after a while, I started seeing some just crazy activity happening on base. For instance, there was this guy who, staff sergeant, who went into the sound center where you could buy stereo equipment, and he would crawl through the Quonset hut. Go through the ceiling tiles and go in and steal all this equipment. And when they caught him, he had a harpoon as his weapon. I was thinking, oh my God, it was just that kind of stuff going on that was just so crazy. And we went into his room and he moved out all of his personal belongings, and it looked like a storage room for stereo equipment, and he was kicked out. But there were many people that were doing really, really, really stupid things, and you'd kind of wonder what's going on. Why are you doing what you're doing? And it just never quit. I mean, one day I'm on East Gate over at RAF Woodbridge, and somebody, desk sergeant, calls me and says, Rayfelt, did you just shoot your weapon? And I'm like, what? no, no, why don't you? So, you know, people were shooting their weapons off on post. They were just doing things as if they had to get out of there. I mean, there was this whole thing of, I got to get out of here. I can't stand being here anymore. And we had a lot of turnover in the security police squadron. And it was almost as if they just quit. They said, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I got to get out of here. I knew that I had to really, really, at one point, I knew I was under the gun, too. I mean, it was just, you kind of knew that if you kept asking questions, or if you just weren't, you know, you shut up, you stay on your post, you'll survive. And so I pretty much toward the end, just that's all I did. I just pretty much kept quiet. And then it was at that point, February 1980. Now I've been there almost 2 years, and I was at the back gate of RAF Woodbridge. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And we had just checked our buildings, and I was filling in the check sheet. At that point, I looked out toward the North Sea, and I could see an aircraft coming in. And I was just watching it, thinking, oh, okay, this is interesting. I've never heard of an aircraft coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I thought, well, at least this will keep me distracted or entertained. And I kept looking over for the blue lights to go on the runway. And they didn't. And I was thinking, you know, I kept looking at the lights. I'd look over at the aircraft coming in. And the light was actually the shape of like a football. It was kind of, you know, pointed on both sides and, you know, round on the top and bottom. And then it stopped. And when it stopped, we were both just staring at it, thinking something's wrong. And then it hovered about maybe 100 feet off the ground. And then it moved up, down, left, right. And it broke into three pieces and flew across the runway. And then it flew, just shot right up into the sky and disappeared. And we were just staring. It was with Keith Duffield, and we were just staring at it. And we were like, what the heck was that? I mean, I just remember thinking that. And then we started thinking about, okay, well, what do we have, you know, what do we do? I mean, the thing flew across the base. I mean, what if it comes back? I got on the phone. Well, actually, originally I got on the handheld radio and told, you know, police control that this is what we saw. And the guy, Alan Cohen, who was the desk sergeant at the time, was pretty much like, what? So he instructed me to go over to the gate shack that was closed, East Gate, and go in there and get on the phone and talk to him. So I got on the phone and I told him what we saw, and he was kind of like, okay, all right. Then he finally gave me instruction to go over to the air tower and to check with them to see what they saw. So we went over to the air tower, which was maybe half a mile. It wasn't that far at all from Eastgate. Because it was February, it was really, really cold. At that point, when we were walking up the steps, and I can remember there were these metal steps. They were actually outside the building. So you had to go up to the top. And I knocked on the door, and no one answered. So I knocked again. Finally, this guy came up, this airman who looked all disheveled. He was apparently, we woke him up. And we asked him if he saw anything. And he said no. And he then said it might be afterburners from an aircraft. And all I could think of was, well, with afterburners, there's usually a sonic boom involved. And I don't think that's it. But we knew we weren't getting anything with him. And then when I was walking down the steps, this part really, it took me years to really think about it, but it was just so subtle that walking down, I looked out onto the horizon. I remember that toward the across opposite side of RAF Woodbridge, which was part of the forest. And because I was still thinking about the afterburners, I looked out, and I mean, it was daybreak. So it was pitch dark at 3 o'clock in the morning, and now it's daybreak. And then at that time, if you go back, you can actually find out like the length of the days and the nights in February. It should have been dark still, and because apparently not that much time had really gone by. When I looked at my watch, apparently we lost about 2 hours of time, which really, really is kind of creepy. But it's so subtle that you don't know that happened. There was a gap to go from 3 o'clock in the morning to now it's daybreak. We got off duty, and for the next few weeks, people were saying, "Oh, Ray felt seeing UFOs," you know, and I'm like, "Shut up!" So I just pretty much buried it. I really thought to myself, I thought hard about this over the years. I said, you know, if Jesus Christ had come up to me to tell me the meaning of life, I would have to send him to the public affairs office. If that UFO had stopped and wanted to talk to me, I would have had to send him or her to the public affairs office, because there's no way anyone was going to believe me at all. And that really bothered me. And, it was upsetting that was the reality. Unless if I did pursue it too, the other reality was I would have been kicked out. They would have said, you know, she's out of her mind. Even though I would say, well, I've got Keith Duffield was with me, so I wasn't alone when I saw it. And recently I learned that Doc Rhodes also saw the UFO. He was on the main gate at the time. So it's funny how little pieces of the story come out even 40 years later. Time went by, and I was just so bitter about the way I was being treated that I just buried it. I said, you know, again, you know, most people would say, oh, I'd love to see a UFO and whatever. I'm like, it's something that you don't want to, something you don't want to carry. You really don't, you know, because people will judge you for it. And will you get to the bottom of it? And I mean, I really haven't still, but I do have comfort knowing that others had seen it. And then when it came back in December, that others had the experience at a higher rank. And that to me also really made me say, yes, see how it feels, you know, because it's something that's really, it's a burden. But I was curious. I wanted to know exactly what it was, why it didn't make any sound, you know, what the movements meant. And which actually brings up that whole Pilates again, because it's the sign of the cross or whatever people want to call it, with the triangles and that kind of thing, the symbols that they all kind of link together with that star system or that cluster of stars. When you go on the base, you almost feel as if there's this heavy weight that's put on you, or, you know, or it's, if you're walking, it feels like you're walking through something. The atmosphere just seems really heavy. And it's like the gravity is pushing down on you. I had actually, two things that happened when I was there was that I started gaining a lot of weight. And I know part of it was because I was eating probably too much food, duh. But there was also, I had lost my stamina. And I'm only an 18, 19-year-old kid. You know, that should not have happened. And as soon as I left Bentwaters, when I finally, we called it PCS, which is permanent change of station, which meant PCS also means I left. So when I left Bentwaters for good, it's like everything kind of, my body, everything went back to the way it should be. You know, it's like my stamina came back and all this, you know, my weight went back to where it is today, you know. So it was just, you know, just unusual. My mother actually came to visit me when I was there. And it was the first time I got the chance to show her an Air Force base, because she'd never been around one. I grew up in New York. And so I was excited about showing it to her. And we drove on to the, you know, I was pointing out different things to her. And I pointed out the runway, and then an 810 kind of drove by, crossing. I had to stop to let this 810 go by. And, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. You know, look how close I can get to the airplanes, Mom. But she was really quiet. And I was phone and said, Mom, what's wrong? And she said, Lori, I got to get you out of here. She goes, there's something wrong about this place. This is my mom. I never told her anything about it. But she was planning on getting me on the next plane to get me, to save me from Bentwaters. And I told her, I said, you can't. I said, Mom, you can't bail me out. This isn't like a record club. You know, you can't fix this. I have an obligation. I have a commitment that I have to fulfill, you know, and so I got to stick around until the end. She was good about it, but I think at that point she was worried and she felt as if someone was following me or keeping an eye on me. And we went off base to where I was living. I was living in Wickham Market at the time, and I showed her my little place, and she said, yeah, there's something wrong here too. I'm like, Mom, knock it off. And we went to visit a friend of mine who lived in Camp Siash. And it was at the first moment my mom finally said, you know, I feel like I can relax. I can breathe now. But I just remember that story because my mom picked up on it, the same thing when I picked up on it originally. But I had to put it in perspective because I had to deal with it. I mean, that was my lot in life there. And but anytime I was able to get away from the base, everything always felt lighter to me. You know, that was why I would always say to people, they would say, well, how did you like being in England? I said, I loved England. I loved the people there. It was great. I hated Bentwaters. I hated it. I mean, it was just, my stress level would go through the roof because it was just, there was something about the place that wasn't right.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
You know, going back to Harpoon Guy, mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of the Joseph Heller book, Catch 22.
Yeah, I read that book.
Where everyone's doing crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the harpoon, because I was telling these other guys that, oh, that's not going to happen, you know. And sure enough, it did. And when I went into his room, and first when I was at the desk and I saw the harpoon, I thought, oh my God, what if one of my colleagues or somebody, what if somebody got harpooned? I mean, you know, how could that, you know, I don't even know if it would work outside of water, but if it did, to me that seems really horrifically painful. The other thing that was interesting about the place was that not far off the base at Bentwaters side, there was this huge mansion that I don't think it's there anymore, Ivy Lodge, near Ivy Lodge. And the gate's there, but the mansion itself is not there. Ivy Lodge was a place, it was a mansion, and then they took over it by the military. And then the military, it became a hospital. Then it became a hospital for people with, I think, like alcohol problems and I think psychiatric kind of problems. It was so interesting that the dormitories on the RAF Bentwaters side was really close to that place. You know, people say, well, you know, when you're young and you're airmen, you're going to drink a lot. Well, the drinking they did over there, and then I can fast forward and look back at the other bases I was at, was nowhere near what they were doing or drinking or whatnot over at Bentwaters. And, I mean, kids got there, they were not alcoholics and soon became alcoholics. I mean, it was just, you know, they would cause a lot of havoc in the dormitories. And in fact, one time we had to go to the dormitory and there was this one kid that was putting all the showers on and flooding the place out and having, it was like hot, the hot air from the showers was rolling into the hallway, and the then he took out a fire extinguisher and started getting all the steps messed up. And this, my flight chief had told me to follow this guy who was drunk, and he was 6'5". He looked like a brick of a you know, he was like solid muscle. And he slipped and fell on the stairs, and the guy that was the instigator said, "She pushed you." And I'm like, "Oh no." So I called for backup, and the backup came and saw that I was about ready to get beat up, and he took off. He got scared. So I took off. I'm not going to get beat up. I'm not going to be there by myself. So it was just a lot of crazy things like that going on. So I went back to the flight chief and I told him I did not get the ID card from the guy because this other guy caused him to slip and fall. And I would have gotten the ID card if I got beaten up really badly. You know, I just wasn't going to do that. He was disappointed I wouldn't do it. And then somebody took his radio and threw it on the roof. I mean, it was a disaster. It was craziness that happened and shouldn't have happened.
Definitely strange things going on. So it couldn't really be contributed to the fact it was a nuclear facility.
You know, I look at that too, and I do think that the powers to be, and I'm not talking about the powers to be, the human powers to be, but I do think that the nukes had a big, now it's probably a huge part of the atmosphere, and I'm thinking that whether it's from Pallades or wherever, the behind the scenes of whoever this entity is that they were worried about us as if we were children playing with matches, you know? So, yeah, I think they had an eye on us, make sure we really didn't do anything stupid. But, yeah, I think that was a big part of it. I think there was a problem in the fact, too, that I don't think the people in England were aware that we had these. And I really think there was something in the law. I don't know how they got away with actually having nuclear bombs there.
Those few months, especially during the Cold War, you know, it did come very close, didn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, the Cold War to me was almost invisible, you know? I mean, it was... We were afraid of something that we really didn't know, I think, if we should really be afraid of. I think that, you know, the Vietnam War was something I think would have been frightening to be a part of. But the Cold War, I went to the VA, the Veterans Administration Hospital once, and I sat in between these guys. It's three guys and me. And the one guy... I looked at him and said, "So, what war?" And he said, "Vietnam War." And I'm like, "Man, that's a bad one." And the guy next to him, he said, "I said, what war?" And he goes, "Korean War." And I said, "Yeah, my dad was Korean War. That was a bad one too." Then this other guy, I could feel him, his eyes boring in on me, and he said, "You know," I said, so I had to ask him, "What war?" And he said, "Oh, World War II." I said. That was really bad. I'm just nodding no, saying, "Oh man," and then they were all looking at me like, "What war?" And I said, "Cold War, really cold." They didn't even give me a sweater. So I guess the whole thing with the Cold War, we were afraid of the Russians, but I don't think we really had much information to realize that they possibly could be broke. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, of course, things change. There's new enemies, a new decade, new enemies.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, we were actually 1978 when I was in basic training, we were actually training Iranian officers at that time because they were in the dormitory below us. So yeah, I mean, one day you. We're training the Iranians. Next day, they're using all that training against us, you know? That's, it's like another catch-22, you know? And again, it could all be another distraction to keep us off of trying to pay attention to what's really going on that we really can't see, or we really, you know, again, we can't focus on finding out just what is going on with this, you know, with the, whether it's UFO sightings or, you know, anything paranormal.
Yeah, a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah. And I, you know, but it's interesting when you hear, you know, bits and pieces of the stories, say, you know, I've been watching some of the trailers from Capel Green, and in it they have different stories, experiences from other people, and hearing what they had to say just really, you know, it gave me great comfort knowing that I wasn't alone. You know, I mean, in many ways that's been huge, even with my Rendlesham Lone Ranger UFO site on Facebook. I mean, there are a lot of really, really kind people out there that are really wanting to help me figure it out, and hopefully maybe helping them, because we know that, you know, we're not alone in this universe. Well, maybe we are alone in this particular part of the universe. I don't know, but you know, we're not alone.
How did you actually get involved with the making of the movie?
Yeah, actually, it was interesting is that one of the guys, Tim Akison, who is one of the people that's working with it, he actually was going out to RAF Bentwaters in Eastgate area, and he was doing a lot of finding out information about the radiation in the area and the different, you know, so he was trying to come up with some physical, tangible evidence of the place. And he talked to Gary and told him, you know, have you seen this doctor, you know, Disclosure Project, Lori Rehfeld? How come no one's paid attention to it? He said, you know, she experienced something that actually flew into military territory. And the thing is that this happened, this is like precursor to the events in December. I mean, this should be seen as something very, very important because it's, you know, A, it's happened before, and B, he just felt it was, you know, important to get not just the looking at those 3 days. It just seemed like it was, there's more to the story. So he contacted, he put me in touch with Dion, and Dion actually contacted me, and we talked and everything like that. And I told him, I said, look, I'll tell the whole story. I mean, I will tell you my whole story of almost everything that I experienced there, because there was some crazy stuff going on. Yeah, you're going to hear some things that you're going to, you know, at least in my head, I never wanted to really share because it just seemed too crazy or too outlandish. But, you know, it was definitely part of my story. So he got in touch with Tasha Cooney, who is one of the, she does the video recording. And she came over to my house, and we worked on it. We only spent maybe a few hours, and then we came back the second day. So we did maybe 2 days of the interviewing, and I was really excited because this is the first time I'm able to get my story out in such a such a big way, and you know, and I just think that, you know, it's about time. But the other thing that really was bothersome is the fact that there are a lot of people over the past year or two who are prejudging something they haven't even seen. You know, I'm like, how can you do that? Or how could you feel like what can you base it on to say, you know, oh, this is going to be about this and this and this, or it's going to be garbage, or it's a real con job, or blah, 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 you know, whatever. You know, I look at these people that are making these comments and thinking, you got to see the film. I got to see the film. You know, I mean, maybe I'll feel the same way after I see the film, but I doubt it. And I like the guy, Dion. His he's got a real, he's putting his heart into it. He's not, you know, you can tell this is like his baby, and he's really gone really far out to be able to get the story done correctly and to get the pieces together. But the story has evolved. That's one thing that makes it even more interesting, is because at first, if they were looking at the 3 days, then all of a sudden, now this story, Capel Green, has completely evolved. And that's to me, that's really exciting, I think.
Set for release 2020.
Yeah, I think in July of 2020. They were finding more and more witnesses that were willing to talk. I was wondering, did you ever hear about the one? This is one story, and I don't think it's going to be in Capel Green, but you never know. Did you ever hear? I was talking to this one guy, and he was telling me that, and this happened actually 2 separate times, someone told me about this, about the lady on the bicycle without the face. There's this part of the, to go from East Gate at Woodbridge to Butley Gate, which is over at Bentwater side. There was this road that was surrounded by the forest. And I always thought it was so phenomenally beautiful. But this one guy told me the story about, he said, yeah, he goes, that place really freaked me out. He goes, one day I was driving a metro van. When you're driving a metro van, that means there's no windows in the back, so no one else can see. Only the driver can really see what's going on. And all the other guys were sitting in the back. And he said, he looks out his side mirror, and he sees this woman on a bicycle, and she looks young. At least he can see what he could see, but it looked like a real old bicycle. Then he noticed she doesn't have a face, and he's like, holy, you know, he got really scared. So he starts driving as fast as he can. So now he's going about 50 miles an hour, and I mean, he's booking, and he looks out the window, and this woman on the bicycle is right beside him. It's like the faster he goes, he can't get her away. Finally, he gets to where he's going, and she's gone. But he said that was one of the scariest things he ever experienced. And I'm thinking, oh, thank God I never experienced that. But I can imagine it, though. You know, it's there were just a lot of crazy things happening at both Bentwaters and Woodbridge. You've probably heard about East End Charlie. East End Charlie is a walking runway, I think. The headless pilot who crashed onto the base, and apparently he left a mark on the hood of a fire truck or something, a burn mark, and they said when they see him, he's in flames or something. They had just a lot of story. There was a lot of witchcraft, they said, going on over there. I mean, the first thing I heard about the area we were in, it was like the most haunted county in the world. You know, and I'm thinking, okay, that's nice. But it's fascinating. But, and I have gone back to visit. I went back in 2000, and I actually wrote a piece about it, about my visit there. It still felt the same. It still felt the same. It felt like there was still a heaviness to the place. I'll probably go back there again, because of the fact that it's so much a part of me.
Really appreciate you coming on. It's been great having you on.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you and getting to meet you.
That's all we have time for today. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. I will be back next Monday. Stay safe and have a great week.
face of my worst enemy, and that was you.
My guns, you are leaving.